Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, hosted by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called The Infancy of Toxicology with special guest Deborah Bloom. So now, here's your host, D.P. Lyle.
Thanks, John. And I want to welcome everybody to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. We got a very special guest today and some very interesting ground to cover that those of you who are interested in crime and particularly crime writers will really, really dig into this. As I always say, when we start these shows, remember, go to my website or to the Crime and Science Radio site and you will find links to some interesting further study on everything we're going to talk about today with Deborah, and you can further your education there. So without further ado, my guest today is Deborah Bloom, who wrote the wonderful book, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. Now, Deborah's originally from Illinois, but she got smart at the ripe old age of two and moved to the South, came down the Mississippi to Louisiana. And there, she and her sisters, interesting enough, the four Ds, Deborah, Darcy, Dawn, and Dana, stomped around in the swamp collecting critters as children. And this was probably because her father was an entomologist. And so a lot of her younger life was spent on bug hunts, which I find fascinating. She was educated at Florida State University and then at Georgia, where she earned a degree in journalism, but she then worked for several newspapers covering mainly crime and courts. But ultimately, the pull of science pulled her into more scientific topics and towards science stories and books. And then in 2010, all of this journalism and science knowledge that she accumulated led her to writing and publishing The Poisoner's Handbook. Deborah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about, because I grew up in the South, too, and I grew up stomping around in the woods and streams and forest and collecting all kinds of critters, much to my mom's dismay. But tell us a little bit about some of your adventures you had with your sisters there.
Well, I don't know that we dismayed my mother as much as my father did. My father really believed that nature should not be left outside. And so he would take us on all of these different bug hunts and creature hunts, and then we'd bring them home. So for a while, we had a container of garter and ribbon snakes on the dining room table. And he would take us out, you know, bug collecting, and we'd bring those home. And then I've asked myself if this influenced the way I thought about the world. But later he got very interested in much more poisonous insects. Actually, one of my younger sisters stepped into a fire ant nest. If you grew up in the South, I'm sure you remember fire ants.
Yes, nasty
and those creatures. Suckers hurt, right? She stepped into a nest, got covered with bites, and none of them got infected. And so he started looking at the chemistry of them and discovered that fire ants actually inject an antiseptic when they sting you. And so they're sterilizing. I have no idea why, but they sterilize you as they go. And from there, he just kept bringing these guys in. There was a point in my high school when we had a black widow as our centerpiece in the dining room table. And as I like to tell people, when I got my first apartment in college, he gave me a tarantula as a housewarming present. So I actually had her for 2 years. At least I think she was a she, but I had her for 2 years. So it was an interesting childhood.
Exactly. I think that was when my parents drew the line too. I brought a black widow in a jar, an old ball dome mason jar. And my dad said, "Where did you get that?" I said, "Well, I found it out in the wall there. We were at my grandmother's house." And he said, "Well, how did you get it out of there?" I said, "With a spoon." Boy, I tell you, he hit the roof. I just spooned that sucker out and put it in.
And here it is.
Here it is. Look what I made for you in shop.
And, you know, the thing is, they're actually very beautiful.
Yes,
black widows. They're just gorgeous. But, yeah, I wouldn't have played one with a spoon either.
No, people who have never seen one, I mean, they literally shine like they're shellacked. They're really bright black and almost where they just jump at you in that red mark on their back. They're gorgeous animals.
They're gorgeous, and they're elegant, aren't they?
They will kill you.
Yeah. They're like walking warning symbols, right?
So you started out as a chemistry major in college and then switched over to journalism, isn't that right?
I did, and I loved chemistry. I still love chemistry. And I'd probably be a chemist if I wasn't a phenomenal klutz. So my year as a chemistry major, they actually had to evacuate the lab that I was working in when I generated a toxic cloud. And then I set my hair on fire. That was a memorable
You were next to me in the chemistry lab. I remember you.
Everyone's backing away. Really, I had the most fabulous postdoc who was running that lab. And he comes up. I'm just working away. He goes, "Deborah, do you smell smoke?" I had these long braids. I looked down. They're on fire. And I literally went home and called my father and said, "That's it. I am done with chemistry. I'm getting out now while I'm in one piece."
And so that's that when you switched over to journalism and decided to follow that route.
Not in a brilliant kind of here's my life calling way, but a, well, what am I going to do with myself now? But, I really love to write, so I think I'll major in journalism. And the funny thing is, I mean, it took me about a couple of years into it when I realized how much I liked journalism, because I like to know how things work, and I'm nosy, right? And I hate for people to say no to me. And and all, you know, longtime journalists spend most of their career trying to get around the word no so they can get their story.
Well, that's a great combination, having an interest in science and some education in chemistry, and then move into the journalism world, because open up that segment of journalistic work that I think a lot of journalists wish that they knew more about science so they could dig into that area.
You know, and I grew up with science and experimented with it. And then when I eventually went back to grad school, I got a grad degree in science journalism. So, and that was after I literally stopped myself. I'd been at newspapers about 5 years and said, you know, if I'm going to do this for the rest of my life, I want to do something that really fascinates me. And my kids will tell you this, I'm a geek at heart, so it was science for me. I've been doing it for about 20 years now.
Now, your husband Peter and I have something in common. We're both dummies. We've both written for the dummies world, and he wrote World History for Dummies, and I know you have a love of history, too. Did you help him with that in any way?
I did not. Except I always, you know, say to people that, you know, my poor kids grew up with the two of us. We'd sit down at the table and one of us would pick up a fork and I would be, you know, there's an interesting number of metals in this. And he would be, let's talk about the history of the fork, right? So the two of us together, total nerd family cubed, right? But no, we've bounced a lot because we both love history. So, you know, when I'm working on a history story, a book, and a lot of my books are sort of narrative science history, you know, I'll say, well, what about this, or what do you think of this? And then, you know, candidly, the other great thing about him is he is a fabulous editor. So he's read and edited a draft of everything I've written, and he always improves it.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Did he help you with the Poisoner's Handbook? Did he offer any insights historically or help with the writing process in that in any way?
Well, when I was working on it, when I first started working on that book, I had, and I still do, I have a wonderful library of books about poison. I'm sitting there at my desk with stacks and stacks of books about poison. He helped by saying, I was working on the proposal, and he looks at me and he goes, "And when I die, everyone's going to know you did it." And I put that in my proposal for the book. I started out by saying, you know, I'm not really planning to poison my husband, but so that was a huge help to me. But mostly he's an absolutely wonderful editor. So when I have got a draft together, he'll look at it and he'll and he'll literally say to me two things. One is, you could say this better. And every writer needs someone to say that to him. But the other thing he'll say to me is, you could say this in English, right? Because
yeah.
I sometimes can go right down the rabbit hole of, you know, some wonderfully complicated science, and he's great at pulling me out of that.
Yeah. I think that's one of the problems that scientifically trained individuals have when they start trying to write. We were talking about earlier before we came on the air that the book is so wonderful because it is very narrative and it is almost like reading a novel. There's so many characters involved. But you can get so deep in the weeds with the science because that's you understand it and you can lose the reader very quickly.
And I always, and you know, it's one of the things that you can say to yourself, you can say, well, everybody knows, right? Everybody knows that this is how arsenic kills you. Everybody knows that, you know, when I say corrosive sublimate, I'm talking about an evil mercury formula. So I always have to keep doing that. Everyone doesn't know that, right?
Well,
and
exactly.
So tell that story as if, no, you know, you and the reader didn't have a clue, and you're figuring it out together. And I, you know, that's important to me. Let's do this together.
Right. Well, as Denzel Washington said in the movie made on the John Grisham book, I forget which one it was now. He said, "Talk to me like I'm a sixth grader, or talk to me like I'm 6 years old, or something like that."
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot to be said. Be concise. Where did this story come from? Where did you conceive the idea for this Poisoner's Handbook, and how did that all evolve? Because it's not just a textbook about the early days of toxicology. It's really a story of people and events and cases. And where did you come up with this concept? How did that evolve?
That's a great question, and I wish I could tell you that I was just brilliant, but what happened was I'd actually been thinking about writing essentially a book that was basically a handbook of poisons for a while, and Poisoner's Handbook at one level is just that, right? Every chapter is a poison, and it tells you about the poison and how it works, and it's also the story of these two scientists who are fighting to build what I think of as really our CSIH. And so I knew I wanted to do the Handbook of Poisons. I think poisons are so interesting to me because they're so smart. Now I'm not going to sound like a scientist, but if you think about the fact that we are exposed to chemicals all the time, right? You breathe them, you drink them, you eat them, they don't hurt you. The ones that actually get in there and do a number on you have to be really clever, right? Turn the right key, betray you in some way. And so I'd been just thinking about that for a while. I'd love to get at that cleverness of poisons. And so I pitched this to my editor and agent in a very short, I'm not going to kill my husband, but poisons are cool kind of way, sold the book, and then said to myself, what the heck is that book about, right? I mean, poisons are a really cool story, but I don't want to write an encyclopedia either. And I've often thought the two scientists who are at the heart of my story are two, they're really civil servants, right? The first medical examiner in New York City, he came in 1918, brilliantly hires the first toxicologist ever to work for an American city. And the two of them start building forensic science, which doesn't exist. We don't even teach forensic science in this country for another 15 years, right? It's just an incredible thing. And they were had just disappeared into footnotes. And so I'm hysterically flapping around. I really was, too. Where's my story? Where's my story? Going through all kinds of different poison things. And I literally pulled them out of the internal newsletters of the American Society of Forensic Toxicologists. And I thought, man, these are really interesting people. I'll just find their biography. But it didn't exist. And so I spent about the next year finding these guys and finding that story and building this mosaic. And it's a funny thing to say this as a writer. I love the period. I mean, the early 20th century is a fabulous, you know, wild, anarchistic, amazing period in history. But my guys, you did something so remarkable in that time period with so few resources, and I love that I rescued them, if that makes sense, that they had disappeared into footnotes, and I was able to pull them out and say, look what two people can do if they're determined to change the world. So that's the other part of the story.
Yeah, and I think it's good. And we're talking about, of course, Charles Norris, who was the chief medical examiner of New York at that time, and Alexander Gettler, who was a forensic toxicologist, though. That was before there was such a thing as a forensic toxicologist.
That's exactly right.
But he knew bugs, and he knew poisons and toxins. These two guys, as you said, created a partnership that really was astounding. And I think they were, first of all, they were both very well organized, very thoughtful, very honest in their approach. They didn't
mm-hmm.
suffer fools.
No,
and,
they didn't.
And they knew what they were about, even though no one else knew what they were about for a long time. They had to prove their mettle. What did you learn about these guys separately or together outside of their scientific abilities that kind of set you back and said, wow, these guys are really special?
You know, and they were so different. So Charles Norris was the first trained medical examiner ever to hold a position in the city of New York, and he replaced this phenomenally corrupt coroner system, right? You know, when you go back and you look at it, and I say to people, you know, we take this the sort of Charles Norris's of the world for granted, but he stepped in. They had a doctor who was the chief coroner who was literally such a famous alcoholic that when you read about him in the New York Times of the time period, he had to hire two assistants to just hold him up at crime scenes. And Charles Norris is rammed down the city of New York's throat. They don't want him. They like their corrupt system. And he works because he is from an old-time East Coast family, a really wealthy East Coast family, the Norrises, who founded Norristown, Pennsylvania. So he's independently wealthy. And he comes from this long history of public service. The Norrises of Norristown, Pennsylvania, literally stripped the lead gutters off their house during the Revolutionary War and had them melted down for bullets for the Continental Army. So it's, you know, he's been raised in this tradition. And so he comes in, and he can't be pushed around, and he can't be bought, right? And he can't be threatened, and he can't be undermined by budget cuts, because when the mayors do try to undermine him, he just uses his own money.
Exactly.
He really believes that this man, he believes so much, he really spends tens of thousands of dollars of his own money. And Alexander Gettler is nothing like that at all. He's the son of a Hungarian poor immigrant. He puts himself through college working as a ticket taker on a ferry. He is, marries a nice Irish Catholic girl and lives in Brooklyn, whereas Norris has a fancy brownstone on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. But they are both alike, and they are completely obsessive, right? No,
right.
I mean, Gettler sits up in bed till 2 o'clock in the morning designing experiments, and I always imagine making his wife crazy. And neither of them quits. They're complete bulldogs, right? So Norris goes to the opera. Gettler goes to the races. He was a gambling fanatic, right? But when they're doing this professionally, they're, man, we're going to make this the best science ever, and we are going to catch people who could not be caught before, and we're going to change this. And they did.
Yeah, they were an amazing pair. And I think it's important that, that Norris did come from a wealthy background, which you makes you wonder as I'm reading through the book, and I stop and wonder how much of this would have happened had it not been for that.
And
because he literally
great.
Had to take his own funds to make the lab run and to make things run at many junctures, not only because there was no money, but also because of the political intrigue. There were people out there trying to really pull the rug out from under him at every step.
All the time. You're absolutely right. And you would see him coming in. I went to the New York City Municipal Archives and read his letters where he's going, the mayor won't even fund the clock in the morgue. And we have to have a clock in the morgue so we can measure these things in a time frame. So I'm buying the clocks. Or the city won't pay for this assistant chemist. Well, too bad for the city. I'm paying for this. And I came to the same conclusion you did, I think. I thought, if it hadn't been him, and he was not the first choice, by the way.
Right.
He was like the second on the list of candidates. He was not the first choice. But if it hadn't been him, and if he hadn't had those resources, and if he hadn't been willing to put those resources behind this, I don't think that they could have built what they built. I mean, he was a smart scientist. Gettler was a smart scientist. But if you didn't have someone willing, I'm going to use the word infrastructure, to invest in the actual infrastructure, and when the government was, you know, saying, oh, we're not going to pay for this, saying, well, I will,
yeah.
I don't think they would have moved it forward the way they did. And it's very interesting to see in this time period them building the science and building a relationship of trust with police officers and sort of rewriting things with Norris always backstopping it. You know, he was really an amazing guy.
I mean, even in little things. I mean, like, they wouldn't provide him transportation to the crime scene.
Yes.
And so he had to provide that for himself. And
isn't
it seems something
crazy?
So basic, but he could not get to the crime scene to look at the crime.
I know. They're like, no, we're not going to pay for that. Take the subway like everyone else.
Right.
Like, take the subway.
The chief medical examiner. Yeah.
Right. And if you show up sometime during the day, and part of that was, you know, this ongoing battle, and part of it was cheapness, and part this lingering corruption, right?
Sure.
There was a lot
yeah.
of times when they did not want these crimes to be solved.
Oh,
right?
Sure. Sure.
They had sold it away.
Well, people have been getting away with poisonous murders for centuries, so they didn't mm-hmm. like these guys coming in saying, whoa, wait a minute.
That's exactly right. I mean, and people go back, these guys are early 20th, right? But people will talk about the 19th century as the golden age of poisoners, right? So they're right on the cusp of this change. And there were a lot of people who liked the golden age of poisoners, who worked for them, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
The inheritance powder, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're gonna talk about some of these poisons. Let's talk about one, and then we're going to take a break, and we'll come back and get some more. One of the fascinating ones, which, of course, as a physician, it absolutely revolutionized medical care by allowing surgery, but it also, when used inappropriately, becomes deadly, and that's chloroform, which had we not had, surgeries would have been like it. I remember why I went to medical school, I don't know, after seeing Gone with the Wind. I remember the terrible scene where they saw the guy's leg off. But that's pretty much the way it was. I mean, even though chloroform was around, they didn't have it available all the time, and they had to whack legs off and arms off to save lives, and they did it with alcohol and biting, you know, holding people, holding them down. And
that's
the surgeon's
right.
best friend was speed back then. So tell us a little bit about chloroform and how that was used in more dastardly ways.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. The chloroform came in as kind of a savior. It was invented by a doc over in the UK who was really thinking about helping women in childbirth. And And ether was also floating around, but the problem with ether is that it's very flammable. So they'd be back in the day, they'd operate by candlelight, and then they'd set the operating room on fire, which was not a happy ending.
It happened often.
Yes. So chloroform was like this miraculous thing, and everyone used it, right? Doctors were leaping to it, and they prescribed, they used it in surgeries, and they prescribed it to, you're a little stressed out, take some chloroform. You used to actually be able to buy like a bottle of chloroform and a sponge, and you put the chloroform soaked sponge over your nose and get a little chloroform. I'm never sure if it was an up or a down, but you were definitely relaxed. The problem was there were two things. One was, and doctors probably started realizing this in the early 20th century, chloroform's like a loose cannon of an anesthetic, right? Sometimes it just puts you nicely to sleep and you pop back up, and sometimes it killed you. And they could never figure out the right dose because it was an unpredictable killer. And so starting about this time, in the early 20th century, doctors were starting to go, we can't really trust this. And at the same time, criminals were starting to go, man, this is a great poison, right? And it's interesting because you can see this sort of rise of the chloroform criminal. They used it a lot, actually, in home break-ins. You'd get a knock on the door, you'd answer the door. People were a lot more friendly about answering their door to strangers in those days. And they just, whap them out with chloroform and steal everything in the place. And I used that to open the book. And I used it in a couple of ways, that sort of backstory of chloroform, but also I had found right about 1915, this chloroform serial killer who was working in a kind of an old folks' home in the New York area and finally comes in and confesses that he's killed all these people. And he's pretty happy about it. I mean, he doesn't feel bad about it. They were old. They needed to go was kind of his motto. But he essentially walks, because they don't know enough about the science to nail him. And you actually, there's this fascinating scene where the coroner, again, completely untrained because they were, says, we don't even need to look at the bodies because no one can find chloroform in a corpse. Whereas there's actual textbooks at the time where that's not true. So you see science enabling the criminal to get away. And so that was interesting to me, too. And that's important in my story because we really do take for granted this kind of partnership between science and criminal justice, right? And that the police work in good faith with scientists. But the track record was so bad in the early 20th century. So many cases were lost because coroners didn't know that literally you could get away with murder.
Yep. Well, we're going to take a brief break here, and then when we come back, we're going to dig into some of the nasty poisons that were uncovered in the research and her book and how she exposed them in this wonderful tome, The Poisoner's Handbook. We'll be back.
An offering of reason.
Welcome back, everybody, here to the second segment of Crime and Science Radio, The Infancy of Toxicology, with special guest Deborah Bloom. And now here's your host again, D.P. Lyle.
Welcome back, everybody, and a conversation here with Deborah Bloom, the author of this wonderful book, The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. We talked a little about chloroform before we took a break, and I want to get back to some of these poisons that you discussed in this book and talk a little bit more about them, because I know crime writers love to kill people with poison. And to me, one of the most fascinating, not only from a chemistry and a physiological point of view, but from public health, et cetera, points of view, is carbon monoxide. And the story of that you wove in your book is fascinating, because we still see deaths all the time from carbon monoxide, accidental deaths. Every medical examiner will tell you when you walk in, when you go to a scene and there's multiple people dead without trauma laying in an area, you better think carbon monoxide, especially if it's in a home or a trailer or something like that. So tell us about the carbon monoxide and how that fit into this wonderful book.
And I'm glad to hear you say that. I think we're so comfortable with carbon monoxide. I think we're not as afraid of it as we ought to be. It's a fabulously efficient poison, you know. I mean, just really good at its job. And so I actually put it in two chapters in the book in different ways. And the first one is one of my favorite stories. So if you don't mind, I'll just take a minute to tell this one story. So back in the 1920s, a lot of people used a gas called illuminating gas in their homes. And it was it powered lights, you know, which was why it was called illuminating gas. You know, we think of gas lighting, this was it. But it was used in stoves, it was used in refrigerators, it was used for heat. It was a very nasty, it's a coal-based gas that was a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. So poisonous and explosive all in one package. And there were a lot of accidental deaths, you know, stoves would leak and whatever. And carbon monoxide was so common that a lot of people of the time thought, well, it's really easy to stage a carbon monoxide murder because all these accidental deaths, all I have to do is set up something that looks like an accidental death. And so one of my favorite stories was one that is actually really famous in the history of forensic toxicology. It's a man, so imagine yourself, right? You go to this tenement house on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and there's clearly been a gas leak, and the police are airing out the apartment. And you go into the back bedroom, and there's a young woman in the bed, and she's been dead for a while, and she's cold, and she's pale, and she's stiff. And you, and in this case, this is Alexander Gettler, the chemist who is called to the scene, take a look at the body, and you say, no, it can't be an illuminating gas death. Why? Why is that not an illuminating gas death? Because carbon monoxide has this phenomenally powerful bond with the protein in your blood that normally carries oxygen. It muscles that protein away, and as it does that, it turns your blood, and you would know this, Doug, such a brilliant cherry pink that your skin flushes. You're pink, right? So with this young woman who's cold and pale, it can't be illuminating gas because otherwise she'd have that carbon monoxide flush. And in this case, they take the body back, they find another gas, that's carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide in high levels in the blood is a giveaway of suffocation or strangulation, right? Because you think about the way we breathe. We inhale oxygen, we exhale carbon dioxide, it can't get out. Therefore, you're going to find it in the blood. And after, so you know, it's chemistry, they see those two signs, take a look at the body, and they find bruises, like thumbprint, fingerprint bruises up the back of her neck. And then it turned out that her husband had held a pillow over her face, so long that, you know, he'd suffocated her, and then he'd broken the gas fitting and tried to stage this accidental death. And so you see, and it's, I love that story because it's a great example of this growing science that's starting to understand how chemicals kill you, right? Solving a murder. And it goes on to sort of become the underpinning of a whole lot of other research that Gettler does, in which they really nail the fact that here's what a lethal level of carbon monoxide is, and here's what's killed you, and you can't really fool us, right?
Right. I think that's important. And it's a lot like what we're doing, we're seeing with DNA now, with a lot of cold cases coming forward. Science mm-hmm. keeps marching on. And,
that's exactly
and criminals
right.
who think they got away with something suddenly realize that the science has run them down, that they
that's,
can't hide in the corners anymore because the science is there to bring them to justice. And carbon monoxide was one of those things.
And in that sense, you're absolutely right. It's a groundbreaking poison because right. now you're sending a message to killers. Guess what? We can catch you. We can
mm-hmm.
catch you with this very straightforward chemical evidence. So.
Yeah. And carbon monoxide is so treacherous, and I just have to say this. I mean, it binds with the hemoglobin, the molecule you talked about,
mm-hmm.
300 times more potently than it will with oxygen. So in other words, if you give the hemoglobin, the lungs, the air that comes in and reaches the bloodstream and attaches to the hemoglobin, you give that blood, that molecule, the option of taking carbon monoxide versus an oxygen molecule, it will take the carbon monoxide 300 times more likely. And so what it does is asphyxiate you because you don't carry the oxygen. It kills that part, and it binds very powerfully with it and turns the blood, as you said, cherry red. And it's interesting. People have even died from carbon monoxide poisoning loitering behind ski boats with the engine at idle, because if you have a small percentage of carbon monoxide in the blood, the air that you're breathing, it just overwhelms the oxygen and asphyxiates you. It's very, very dangerous. These poisonings and this realization also changed public health a bit around that time period, started moving toward different forms of illumination, et cetera. And fortunately, Mr. Edison came along,
yes.
which helped a lot.
That's exactly right. I mean, you really saw this. Yes, it made Thomas Edison very wealthy.
Yeah.
So, and you really saw the kind of crime scene I'm talking about. You especially saw in poorer households. They couldn't afford the electricity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were still stuck with the old illuminating gas. And I'm glad you said that, too, about carbon monoxide. You know, I'll say to people, it's you don't realize it. You can be in a room and you actually can be breathing in oxygen because
right.
there's still oxygen, but it doesn't matter, right?
Right.
Because the carbon monoxide just muscles that oxygen away. It's
yeah.
such a powerful effect.
And that's why a lot of people have carbon monoxide detectors in their home.
And
faulty heaters, plugged chimneys. I mean, it happens all the time.
I do a blog for Wired on, you know, in which I pull some of these issues forward. And I did one on carbon monoxide in hotels. Very few states require carbon monoxide detectors in hotels. And every year there are people who die in hotels from carbon monoxide poisoning. And so I'm always sort of waving the carbon monoxide flag. And the other thing that's important about carbon monoxide is, you know, it's not like it gives you any warning. It's not a gas that
no.
you're going to necessarily, you don't smell it. It's invisible.
No.
You don't taste it. And especially if you, and it makes you, you know, you get kind of fuzzy and sleepy. But if you're sleepy, especially if you don't even realize, and in that sense, it's a really scary killer gas.
Yeah, yeah. You go to sleep and you die.
That's exactly
it's
right.
As simple as that. Yeah.
Nothing to wake you up at all.
Now, another very common thing that you discussed, which was cool because it bled over into the Prohibition period, and that were the alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
Ethyl alcohol, of course, is drinking alcohol, and methyl or wood alcohol or denatured alcohol is deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Isopropyl alcohol is somewhere in between, which is what we would call rubbing alcohol, I can tell you.
Right.
And in my training in medical school, I saw a lot of drunks that would drink Aqua Velva or Skint Men and Skin Bracer because the isopropyl alcohol, because to them it was just alcohol. Of course, they would come in absolutely whacked. But of course, by far the most dangerous is methyl alcohol. And people substituted that when ethyl alcohol was no longer legal. Talk a little bit about the cases and your research into the alcohol deaths, because we still see those with binge drinking in college with ethanol, but back then it was with other alcohols.
Right. And Gettler actually did a whole, I mean, he looked a lot at ethanol. Ethanol, which a lot of us drink on a semi-regular basis in wine and beer and spirits, is not as poisonous as its methanol cousin, but it'll kill you if you give it enough of a shot. The big difference is, so let me back up a minute. One of the interesting things about Prohibition, the 18th Amendment goes into effect in 1920 and is lifted or repealed in 1933. And I'll say to people that this is the most anarchistic decade in American history, right? Because you have a constitutional amendment with the full force of federal law behind it, and people start breaking the law right away. In New York City, from 1920 to 1930, there are 30,000 speakeasies, or little illegal liquor joints that flourish, sometimes just at the back of grocery stores, and sometimes in restaurants, and sometimes in shoeshine shops. I mean, they're everywhere. Because people don't want the government telling them what they can drink and what they can't, and a whole host of other reasons. And if they can't buy legal ethanol, then they make it themselves. And one of the things about wood alcohol or methanol is really you can distill anything you want to that's organic, right? So people were, at that time, they distilled their furniture. They distilled sawdust. There was a famous case, at least, I don't know how famous it was, but it caught my attention, of some moonshiners in Tennessee who distilled poison ivy. They were out of fuel, so they ripped the vines, and it was just like, what? So, and all of this gets repackaged and dyed and sold in scotches, whatever, so you can track through the 1920s not only these rise in these little businesses, but this phenomenal rise in alcohol poisoning deaths. I mean, it's like a rocket going up. As people will drink. You say, why do they keep drinking? But, it was like they were playing roulette. It might be good. And why is that? Well, what makes methanol so poisonous? It's really us. To me, that's one of the, I was talking to you about my fascination with clever chemicals. We metabolize ethanol pretty darn well, right? End product is water, it's carbon dioxide, it's nothing too bad.
We got a good enzyme for that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Gettler actually did some wonderful stuff looking at habituation with alcohol. We get better at metabolizing, and I'm putting quotes around that, but we metabolize it more efficiently the more we drink, right? Yeah.
That's why alcoholics can drink a whole lot more than me and you.
That's exactly right. And we're going to keep it that way.
It's called alcohol dehydrogenase. They raise those levels, and they can chew up alcohol faster than the average Joe.
And it is really, and it works for mostly really well, unless you overwhelm it, right? But we don't have anything like that for methanol. And what happens with methanol is we break it down basically to poisons, formaldehyde, formate, formic acid, all the bad stuff. And it happens kind of gradually. So you're drinking wood alcohol. You get the nice little alcohol buzz. It really doesn't taste different. And then a lot of times people just would start, their vision would blur because the formic acid attacks the optic nerve.
Right.
And they'd go blind.
Yep.
And then the methanol would keep stewing away, and then they die. It is bad news. It really is.
It's basically embalming yourself.
That is a perfect description. It's a horrible description, but that's exactly right. And I can imagine those corpses still look great.
Exactly. They're perfectly preserved.
No. And I talked a lot about that. I talked about deliberate poisoning with methanol. I talked about the government using methanol. The government at one point steps in and says, which is kind of a horrifying story, you were sick of people breaking the law, and they keep buying, the bootleggers are buying industrial alcohol and repackaging it. And, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to make the makers of industrial alcohol make it a lot more poisonous. We're going to make them put methanol in it because you can't get it out.
Right.
And we're going to say to people, don't drink this. It's really poisonous.
Yep.
And I mentioned that because Norris and Gettler are like, huge crusade on this, right? Stop doing this. You're killing people. And they did. They killed tens of thousands of people with that policy, which is another reminder of why, you know, moral crusades by your government don't always work in your favor, right?
That's, to me, one of the most fascinating sections of the book was that, for that very reason. It's basically when you cut through all the chaff and get to the wheat, they're basically saying you break the law, we'll poison you.
That's right.
That's basically what the government was saying.
They were, and it's so interesting because when you look at the newspapers of the time, I was reading them, I was thinking, wow, people are calling the U.S. government the Borgia government because of this.
Right.
And there's this fabulous editorial by one of the New York papers that says, and the 18th Amendment is the only amendment that carries the death penalty, right?
Yeah.
So they knew it. I mean, you can go back and forth on this. It goes back to your point about alcoholism.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that happens is there's no, everything's hard liquor during the 1920s, right?
Yeah.
No wine, no beer. So, because what you're making with your little backroom still is hard liquor.
Exactly.
So alcoholism also goes up. And so people keep drinking this stuff. You know, it's a very unromantic look at the cocktail era of the 1920s.
And speaking of Lucrezia Borgia,
yeah.
You also have a section on the queen of poisons, which is arsenic, which, of course, has been around for millennia.
It's a fabulous poison.
And it's still used today, actually. So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the arsenic and how it evolved in this time period.
Well, you know, arsenic comes from a naturally occurring element. So it's been around a long, long time. And you're absolutely right. People were using it for homicidal purposes back to the time of the Borgias and probably earlier. And it was a perfect poison. I mean, you made the reference to the inheritance powder, which was arsenic, right?
Mm.
It was a perfect poison until science ruined it because, again, it's tasteless, it's odorless, it's a broad-spectrum poison, so it mimics natural illness, right? Have an upset stomach, you have a sore throat, you really don't feel well, right? There was no test in the early 19th century. There were zero tests for poison than a corpse, none, right? If you were smart, you fed the last meal to the dog, and if the dog keeled over, you knew you had something bad in the meal, but you couldn't pull it out of a body. And arsenic was the number one. Everyone used it because it was perfect. You could put it in oatmeal. You can actually go back and look at textbooks from the 19th century, and you find, in the crazy way that scientists are, they're mixing it into pudding. Oh, I can't taste it in pudding. I'm going to try it in cream sauce, right?
Right.
So people really used it, and they often used it in a serial way. And it was so frustrating that as scientists started saying, you know, we've got to do something about this, arsenic was the first poison that they developed a test for in a dead body, and that was about 1840.
Right.
Super primitive test, really primitive.
Very primitive.
Yeah.
And
imperfect.
All that.
Yeah, so people keep using it, right?
But it worked both as an acute poison and as a slow chronic poison. It has a lot of ramifications. It has a lot of pseudopodes, as it is. It can move in a lot of different directions. And as you said, can mimic gastrointestinal, neurological, cardiovascular disease. And still today, people get arsenic poisoning either on purpose, and they come in, or by accident, they come into the doctor, and they think they got a gastrointestinal problem.
Yeah.
They work them up for that, because nobody thinks arsenic poisoning anymore.
And so, why would you? It's the same thing.
Right.
I'm one of the other one of the other poisons, I spent a chapter writing about cyanide, which is another famous homicidal poison. You know, today, not to encourage people to use cyanide. Cyanide's a closely controlled poison, but it's not part of the standard tox screen because in the same way that arsenic isn't, right?
That's right.
Why would you look for it? You know, people don't have much access to it and they don't use it. And that really popped. We had a couple of, you probably saw these cyanide murders in the last year in the United States, and that issue with the tox test popped because, you know, we take it for granted now, and some of this is this very field of forensic chemistry, right, that sort of drove those guys into the background that people aren't going to use them. But you're right, you know, a smart poisoner, and poisoners are devious, and poisoners are calculating, right? A smart poisoner certainly would put that into account.
And back prior to the 20th century, or at least deep into the 19th century, arsenic was like the perfect poison.
Mm-hmm.
And so you move yourself forward. Is thallium almost the perfect poison now?
Thallium is almost the perfect poison. And if more people could just get their hands on it, right? So the thing about thallium, so thallium is also a naturally occurring element. And, you know, it's in that same family of kind of metallic element poisons. And the thing about it is that, like arsenic, it mimics natural illness. I told the story about this sort of cascade of death in a one family in my book, and almost all of them get diagnosed with a natural illness. Unlike arsenic, and this is why it makes it almost perfect, it's really not detectable by autopsy. If you suspect arsenic and you open up a corpse, there's characteristic signs of arsenic damage. Thallium it looks like a naturally occurring illness, right? Things just didn't work well, right? Something went wrong somewhere in your body, and it would be an absolutely perfect poison if you could manage the dose so well that your victim didn't go bald. Right.
Right, exactly.
And so
it makes your hair fall out.
It makes your hair fall out. And actually, there's this, it's one of my favorite Agatha Christie mysteries, The Pale Horse. As I spoiled the whole plot here, but that involves thallium, and there's this fabulous scene where these two young women are fighting, and they're pulling each other's hair, and one of the woman's hair comes out and tufts and clumps, right? And everyone's wincing in sympathy because it really hurts when someone pulls your hair. She's like, didn't hurt, nothing, didn't bother me at all. And that's the giveaway clue that it's thallium poisoning. Her hair's detaching from her scalp, right? So there was a case, again, thallium's really a tightly controlled poison. When I wrote the book, thallium and cyanide and arsenic, man, you could go down to the corner grocery and get those things,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
It was just, they were, we used cyanide and silver polish, used arsenic in cosmetic preparations, used thallium and, well, mostly rat poisons and things, but it wasn't hard to get. Because thallium makes your hair fall out, they use it in depilatory creams, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It made a lot of women really sick. so now, now we're kind of saying, you know, back, don't touch. But there was also, again, a murder case in New Jersey last year. It was a chemist at Bristol-Myers Squibb. I'm sure that they love that, saying that. But it was a chemist who got it from sort of the back stores at Bristol-Myers Squibb and killed her husband. And the only reason they caught that was that one nurse in the hospital had seen a thallium poisoning before, and that was in China. And other than that, they wouldn't have caught it. So the good thing, I love those kind of weird gotcha coincidences in the story, but that was what got her. She got convicted of murder, and she's in prison now.
Well, one other thing I want to cover briefly before we wrap this up is, and it seems like the time has flown, we got so much to talk about, is when we talk about murder in general, and, you know, serial killers and poisoners and all this, it seems like we always focus on the person that did it.
Mm-hmm.
not so much the person that it happened to, and particularly not the collateral damage, the ripple effect, what it does to other people and what
yes.
it does to families and communities and society. We focus on the killer. You know, we know who Ted Bundy is, but do we know the sisters and brothers and parents of any of his victims? No, we know nothing about them. And that's kind of sad in a way. But I understand that you've had some communication from some of the descendants of these tales.
Yes. I would love to tell that story. So that carbon monoxide murder I was talking about with the man who, you know, suffocated his wife, I have an actual slide from 1923, which is an autopsy sketch, which is what they used to use instead of photographs, of that woman's body. And I got it from their grandson.
Wow.
And the killer had gone to, you know, did his time, went to jail, did his time, came out, was apparently, you know, a really sweet man on the other side to everyone else for the rest of his life. And his grandson really wanted him to be innocent, really just had been trying for years because he loved him and he couldn't believe he was a murderer. And he sent me that sketch and he said, I just don't believe that my grandfather did this. And I sent him the tox report, right? And he never spoke to me again. And I talked about that. I gave a talk. There were a couple other people. The grandson of one of the arsenic murder. There's a really bad, awful arsenic murderess in my book. Her grandson contacted me. He was trying to find her grave. And she's buried at Sing Sing because the family wouldn't take her body. So I, you know, told him where to go. That was, again, not a wonderful conversation. And there was, there's a story of a young woman who's killed by arsenic in my arsenic chapter. It's a serial killing at a restaurant. And her great nephew wrote me. He sent me a picture of her when she was a little girl. And he said, you know, that she's been a family secret. And she was the daughter of Jewish European immigrants. And he said they never went to synagogue again after her death. They would never talk to her, but they could never believe in a God.
My goodness.
And it reminded me as a writer, these are real people, and murder casts a very, very long shadow.
Yes, it does. Deborah, it has been absolutely fabulous. I wish we had more time talking with you.
Thank you.
Encourage everyone to go buy and read this book, The Poisoner's Handbook. And I remind you, go to the show website or my website, dplylemd.com, and you will see some links there, and you will see a link to the show for where it's archived, and it'll be on both places. Deborah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for letting me come and talk about all these wonderful stories that matter to me.
Cool. Well, that'll wrap up this one, and we'll see you guys next time on Crime and Science Radio.